Welcome to another episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. This is your host, Marshall.
This is Jennifer.
And this is Michael.
And Michael, you're kind of new to the show. You want to tell us some things about your religious background?
Sure. I was born and raised a Mormon. I've got all the Mormon credentials that, that's a big deal for Mormons. Graduated from BYU in 2003. I went through a fairly nasty divorce, and as a consequence, I began to question how my life had gotten to that point, and invariably religion came up. And it, over a process of a month or so, I went from fairly attempting to be a fairly devout Mormon to pretty much an atheist where I'm at now. So And here I am.
Was that a fairly quick process, or how long did that take you?
The final bit where I actually took action was about a month or so. The process of losing, the belief system was 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it wasn't an overnight decision on your part, certainly.
No. Yeah, it was definitely a very heavy decision that was not made lightly.
Mm-hmm. You even went to BYU, didn't you?
I did. Yes.
That's like a Mormon Central right there. I mean, you don't get any more Mormon than BYU.
They're 99.something% Mormon. But they taught me to think. I learned a lot of my critical thinking, a lot of my logic. I'm being a computer programmer. I got a lot of that logic stuff hammered into me, and I can't begrudge them too much because they taught me to think.
So you got a good education.
I did.
I hear that a lot about religious institutions in general is that they teach you to critically think about every other religion, of course, other than your own, and then a lot of people will then take that critical thinking and eventually turn it on to their religion, and
Well, I find that an interesting point, because if you are a religion, with a capital R, and you want to teach your people to be educated, and you want to teach them to think critically so that they can succeed in life, the safest way to do so would be to surround them by thousands of fellow believers at the same time they're learning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting sort of thought that just occurred to me while you were mentioning that.
Well, yeah, and I would imagine that BYU, as you mentioned, 99% Mormon?
Yeah, 99 point something, yeah.
I'm going to assume that the people who weren't Mormon were probably on some sort of athletic team.
probably the majority were on some sort of athletic or performing arts.
Yeah, that's my assumption. But anyway, that's a... Well, go ahead.
No, I just said, but not everybody, because I knew a few people who weren't. You see the people walking around with the turbans on their heads and whatnot, and they clearly weren't out on the football field.
Mm-hmm.
No. Sure, probably there for a program that was really good or something, because I'm sure that the school has really good programs, obviously.
Yep. Business and law. That's what you need to run a religion these days.
Well, anyway, we know Michael through some of our local Kansas City meetup groups. And I think you got started with the Recovering from Religion group, didn't you?
No, I first started with the Freethinking Singles Group.
Oh, okay. All right. But yeah, I know you attended some of those Recovering from Religion groups.
Yep.
That organization was started by our good friend Daryl Ray, who I believe has his own podcast now, or that organization has its own podcast. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but I've listened to it a couple times, and it's pretty good. Excuse me. But anyway, so Michael, it's good to have you aboard. And Howard couldn't make it. He recently got married, and I think he had his house renovated, so we're recording all this by Skype as opposed to his garage. I don't know what the status is with him, if he'll be back on the show or not. If he contacts us, he can let us know. But anyway, that's the situation. And Michael, from my experience with him, is going to do a very good job, in his position. And I guess
appreciate the vote of confidence.
Yes, and I guess there's no reason why we couldn't have five people on the show. But I think four is probably a good number. So anyway, whether Howard returns or not is yet to be seen. So, any interesting things going on with you two?
Well, I recently attended this past Saturday. We had the Million Fag March in Topeka,
mm-hmm.
the protest for the against the Westboro Baptist Church, and we had about 300 people show up and several people from the KC area, and had a good time, and it was, for the most part, a really supportive environment. I only saw one person flip us off, and the rest of us were pretty much like honking and waving, and just, everybody seemed really happy. And one of the girls that I was standing next to had a sign that said "God hates fags" with a no smoking sign on it, because, fag is short for cigarette in Britain, and so many people misunderstood her sign. It was so funny. She actually had two girls make out in front of her because they actually thought that she hated gay people.
Now I really resent that I wasn't there.
Cole has gone in the past 2 years. I understand he wasn't able to go Saturday because he attended. He was out till midnight with Sam Singleton, the atheist evangelist, who was here in Kansas City not too long ago.
Fantastic show.
And he showed up at the march as well. He was there.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
For a while too.
I think so. He attempted to attend one of their services today.
Yes.
I don't know how that went.
He did not even get in the door. I don't even know if he got to pass on his invitation. One of the gals that
the
cold
that actually threw it through the fence.
What's that?
My understanding is that he threw it through the fence at them at their feet.
Oh, okay.
Because they wouldn't even didn't even have the courage to come out and face him.
That's funny. Well, yeah. He is an atheist after all.
Yeah, well, and then there's a video of actually the gal that had the God Hates Fag sign and a friend that tried to go this morning to attend their church service and weren't allowed in at all. They were even escorted away by police.
I have never heard of a church refusing people to attend their services before. I guess they had reason to believe that they might be disruptive. I don't know if they were planning to be, but I've never heard of that before. I've heard of people being kicked out of services for being disruptive, but I've never heard of anyone not being allowed to attend a religious service before.
Sure, yeah.
I'm sure it's happened before, but that's not surprising, but I would have loved it if he had gotten in and maybe sat through the whole thing. Because I understand that that Fred Phelps is quite a preacher. So anyway, last week was Easter, and how'd that go for everybody? Now, Jennifer, you don't have any religious family members, do you?
The few that I do have, they don't. I don't know. It's kind of in our family. It's we don't ask, don't tell. So,
mm-hmm.
So I actually got to go and have ham and stuff with a bunch of my friends who are atheist and agnostic last Sunday night, because we were like, well, if everybody else is feasting, we should too.
That's cool. That sounds awesome. I love
I had a wonderful time with my family. I got to sit and listen to how Jesus had saved us all, and how fortunate we are to all be there, you know, because Jesus was so awesome for us. And I just kind of sat there and internally rolled my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
While keeping my mouth shut, you know, because they can share their beliefs.
Yeah.
But if I dare contradict them, that's unacceptable.
Yeah, that's some of the hypocrisy that I deal with a lot, you know, in my family and even at work with people that were just openly talking about their relationship with Jesus. Here where I live, people go around putting little flyers on your door inviting you to attend their church services, which is annoying because it's just trash. I mean, I'm not going to attend their church services. But I also think of the flack that atheists get whenever they kind of do the same thing in the opposite direction, like with the billboards. I mean, if I had gone around putting, you know, come to this atheist group this Sunday, those flyers on people's doors, people would have been outraged, including fellow atheists.
Yeah, people following you through the neighborhood.
Yeah, and rightfully so, actually. I think it's pretty obnoxious when the Christians do it, but anyway, I obviously did not attend those services. But
yeah, it's one thing to put like a, you know, something up on a billboard or, you know, at a grocery store or something where people, if they're interested, can look at it. But it's another thing to come to somebody's house and leave literature laying around.
Yeah. Well, just future trash. You know, speaking of billboards, the American Atheist, everyone's familiar with that group. Dave Silverman's the head of it. You guys are familiar with it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, they're kind of famous for the billboards. Some of them, which I didn't necessarily think were in the best of taste. You know, it's a myth, and I think there was another one. But they recently put up one mocking the future rapture. I forgot what it said. But it said basically, it's been 2,000 years of any day now. And, of course, this caught a lot of flack from Christians, and probably I wouldn't be surprised if there were a bunch of atheists who were offended by it as well. But that's just another example of them being criticized for doing things that Christians do daily, that we're exposed to daily. And anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this, but I just thought I thought those billboards were kind of interesting.
No, I agree.
We'll go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just saying I agree. I just think it's silly to get bent out of shape about a billboard that's really not even – I don't know. I mean, I suppose this one's a little bit on the offensive side considering it's addressing – you know, it's kind of poking fun at them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, most of the billboards that we put up are not aimed at Christians or any other believer. They're aimed at saying, hey, you atheists out there or agnostics, there's – We're here too. Come hang out with us. And that always bugs me when people get bent out of shape about that kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to personal beliefs, our society does not value overvalues conformity. And so nobody's comfortable being questioned about their beliefs because it's just not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. And it's just nothing but an argument once you start doing that. But this particular billboard, the ones confronting the Rapture Day, and I can't remember the name of the organization that's saying that the world's coming to an end here pretty soon, some Oakland evangelical group. But, I mean, this was fairly confrontational to evangelical Christians who believe in the rapture. I love it.
Yeah, but was it offensive? But were they really attacking all evangelical Christians, or were they really, really poking fun at this one specific group? Because I have to think that there's a bunch of Christians even looking at this going, really? Are you serious? You know?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, and I've got some advice to anyone who wants to predict the rapture, because it's good business in the short term. Don't set a specific date. Make it a very general time frame. You know, predict sometime in the next century, you know, that it's going to happen. Because once you predict that date and it doesn't happen, well, then you look like a total fool.
You mean like the IHOP? Because I think that's what the IHOP groups do. I think that they're basically dedicated to end times and saying it's going to happen in this generation or some such nonsense.
Yes. Yeah,
You know,
and
I can't tell you how many times I heard that growing up as a Mormon. You know, we are. I you know, I was personally told several times that I will usher in Jesus Christ into his second coming in this life. I mean, and my parents were taught that, and my grandparents and my children were taught that. You know, so it's this forever moving target, but it's coming any day now.
Yeah, no, and that's always struck me as an amazing thing about this. There have been surveys done indicating that approximately 50% of Christians believe that Jesus will return sometime in their life, and I guarantee you that this is not a new phenomenon. That
oh, yeah.
since the advent
oh,
of Christianity, every generation thought that, and every generation has been disappointed. And but people still buy this crap, and the tactics.
You know, it's how they build camaraderie. It's how they differentiate and create a group for themselves. It's how they make themselves special.
No, I agree. And my observation is the tactics that they use are kind of clever. You know, the Bible says, you know, you can expect me to return when there's earthquakes or distant wars or things like that. Events that are occurring at any given moment every day of human history, basically. And so they're always able to point to, yeah, it hasn't happened yet, but look at that earthquake. Look at those tornadoes. Look at, there's a war over there. It's right around the corner, and that keeps Christians, the particularly gullible ones, on the hook, and it's been working for 2,000 years now, and I'm constantly amazed that they're still able to go to that as an effective tactic. So I'm always fascinated by these end-of-the-world rapture predictions and everything, and how, despite the fact that every one of them has failed this far, been flat-out wrong, obviously, we wouldn't be having this conversation if any of them had ever been right. They still work. You can still make these claims and fool people. I mean, this organization in Oakland, California, has put up billboards around the world. This is a fringe lunatic group, but they have enough money to put up billboards everywhere. And that's what's particularly amazing.
Of course, has this group predicted the end of the world before, or is this their first shot at it? Because, you know, I kind of think you can only I think that there have been past people who have predicted, oh, the rapture's coming, and they've done it like maybe once or twice, and then after two or three times people are like, yeah, you're full of crap.
Yeah, I think actually, oh, the guy's name is Harold Camping. I think he did it once before, and then obviously it didn't happen. And then he admitted, well, my math was off. It's all based on this bizarre biblical math concept that they come up with, where you find certain terms in the Bible, and then you find out their numerical value, and then you multiply them with other things. And, I mean, literally, it's literally a situation where they're trying to, you know, love equals 12, evil equals 6. You multiply that 12 times, and, you know, and that will tell them the exact number of hours or days between Jesus' death and his return.
Well, right, you know, well, not that movies, you know, are the source of all truth, but if you've seen the movie 23, that just kind of takes that idea and runs with it. And, you know, it's a great, you know, great way to debunk how silly that stuff is by seeing how silly that movie got.
And I have not
seen
it.
Well, I was wondering too. Isn't that basically numerology? And isn't numerology like basically a no-no in Christianity? And, you know,
not biblical numerology. Now,
okay. I wasn't sure. It just seemed like that at one point in time, I had heard something that they were basically like, yeah, they're really not supposed to use numerology anymore.
And you know, in fairness, the sizable majority of Christians probably think this guy is as crazy as we do. The difference is they think he's crazy for different reasons than we do.
Right, right.
You know, they think he's crazy for knowing when it's going to happen. We think he's crazy for thinking it's going to happen. And that's the main difference. But, you know, I don't know how many people worldwide actually buy this stuff. But they have volunteers all over the place driving around in vans, you know, telling people to prepare for Jesus' return. It's just amazing to me that anyone takes this seriously. I mean, people have actually sold all of their property to join this cause because they're that convinced to help finance it because they're that convinced it's actually going to happen. Just based on one person's harebrained mathematical equation that he got.
Well, you know, the trick would be to corner one of these guys and have him sign a contract where he signs over all of his assets, all of his money on the day after.
Yeah.
See if he's willing to put his money where his mouth is.
I think somebody tried that, and they basically said, no, if we have to do that, we're not going to take – I think somebody said they were going to give him like $10,000 if they said that afterwards, if the rapture didn't happen, that they would return their money, and they refused.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't remember what story that was, but it was pretty entertaining, I thought, because I'm like, well, you know.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, that really points to the fact that he's not that convinced of it either. Otherwise, he would have jumped at that. Does this Harold Camping know what we know, that this is just an attempt to confuse and delude gullible idiots? I mean, I don't know. He certainly wouldn't be the first person who used religion to steal money from people. And I'm predicting that he's probably making some money off of this deal. Who knows?
Oh yeah, that's what I figure, is he's making a bunch of money off of it, and that's the reason why he's not going to sign anything to sign it back over, because he knows it's not going to happen.
And then when it doesn't happen, he just shrugs his shoulder. I mean, I don't know. That's got to be a difficult conversation when the day after it was supposed to happen. You know.
Well, no, all he has to play it off is that his believers were so faithful that it delayed it.
Oh yeah, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that they say. Basically, they can come up with anything. He's probably already got his excuse figured out, to be honest with you. So anyway, I'm always fascinated by that stuff. Now I've got I have some good news, especially if you were a victim of the Catholic priest's sex abuse. Turns out that according to what's his name, Bill Donahue, the president of the Catholic League here in the United States. You guys familiar with this lunatic?
No.
You've never seen Bill Donahue? Okay. Well, he's like this really big Catholic advocate, anti-gay and everything like that. He's got good news. If you were an adolescent when Father Bill molested you in the sacristy, you weren't raped. In fact, it means that you're gay and you probably enjoyed it. That's literally what he is saying. He's saying that the outrage over the sex scandals, the numerous sex scandals throughout the world, is fake because most of the people molested were in their adolescence, and if they didn't like it, they wouldn't have participated in it.
Yeah, I think I just threw up my mouth a little bit.
Yeah. I get this from a David Edwards. He's an author for The Raw Story. It came out April 12th. And, I got to find a quote from him. It basically just says that the majority of people who were abused were adolescents when they were being inappropriately touched. And therefore, they must have wanted it. And that's literally what he's saying.
You know, I can't begin to explain how angry it makes me when people blame the victim. I can't fathom that because, you know, here are these real people who have suffered some horrific crimes, and now they're being told that, oh, it was your fault all along. If you really didn't want it, you would have through it or done something else.
Yeah, and that's basically the same.
Well, and even beyond that, if they were an adolescent, well, an adolescent is anywhere from the age of 12 to 18, right? Well, we don't generally recognize that in most states, that if you're under 16, you can even have the wherewithal to consent to having sex.
Yeah, it would still be statutory rape.
Right. Either way you slice it, it's still rape. Whether they wanted it or not. I mean, it just for me too, the absurdity of saying that everybody that was abused was an adolescent is even more maddening, because I'm like, how do you know that? What information do you have?
There was there was some Catholic study into the matter called the John Jay Report, and it indicated that more than three quarters of the victims were post-pubescent.
3/4 of them, but that still leaves right. But that still means that 25% of them were not adolescents and not, and they were prepubescent, which you know, by that, by his logic, they couldn't have you know, said, I want this.
Yeah, and that could be young as around 12, like you said earlier. Well,
or younger.
Yeah, and what he's saying is this is not an issue of clergy abuse. This is an issue of homosexual abuse, because these priests were the problem here is not that they were priests, but the problem is that they were homosexual. But there was another study in the same story.
That doesn't even make any sense.
I know. It's,
well, and the other thing that doesn't make any sense is most pedophiles are not gay. Most pedophiles are straight.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's another story or a study put out by the Survivors Network of those abused by priests that indicates that half of the people, of the children abused, were female, which is kind of an underreported story. But
actually, that is, and I think that there are a lot of older, you know, not even like, you know, teenage. I think there's even older girls that have been abused by being raped by priests who, you know, take their position of trust and abuse it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to admit, I've not heard the number that included up to 50% females. I haven't heard that. All I've ever heard is it's the boys.
So
it's any different based on gender, but I haven't heard that statistic before.
Right. There was I can't remember the name of the documentary, but I did watch a documentary about abuse, of sexual abuse by priests of youth, and they followed both the story of a boy and a girl that were both abused by the same priest, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And he's just run around free.
Yeah.
So would that make that girl homosexual as well, since she liked it?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, she obviously, because if she was 12, she could have said, no, I'm not interested, father, and just walked off, obviously. So she wanted it.
You know, because adolescents don't look up to people like, I don't know, priests or adults or anything, you know.
Yes, and if a priest tells a 12-year-old girl, hey, if you tell anyone, you're going to go to hell or no one's going to believe you, she's not going to buy that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, she'll the first thing she'll do is she'll go home and say, this is ridiculous, Dad. This is what he told. This is what happened. No.
Yeah. No. And, you know, and there are plenty of stories where actually that did happen. And the parents were like, no, he did not do that. Or they believed him and said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. He's a priest. Just try to stay away from him from now on. A lot of stories where that happened. And, you know, I have a good friend who's a devout Catholic. And whenever this comes up, and I've brought it up with him a number of times, you know, he always tries to, you know, dismiss it as, well, of course, every organization is going to have a certain number of pedophiles. And that's completely, I think it's deliberately missing the point. And this is an argument that Bill Donahue makes as well. It's not the fact that there are pedophiles within the Catholic Church, within the priesthood. That's the main issue here. That's part of it, because statistically, there's actually a large, there are more pedophiles in the priesthood than there are in the general population, according to certain studies. But the main issue here is the cover-up, the centuries of cover-up, where priests were just removed from one diocese or, sometimes from one diocese to another, but usually from one parish to another, where they still had access to children and they were able to exploit that.
Exactly. If this were to happen in a public school, for instance, that teacher would not find another job working with children. Or they'd be in prison.
They would be in prison, yeah.
Both. They would probably go to prison, and if they were released, then they would never be able to work with children again. And if they did, then they would go back to prison again. It's ridiculous to even say that, it's every organization has pedophiles. Of course, you know, of course you're going to have, you know, wherever there's children, unfortunately, you're going to attract, you know, pedophiles, but yeah.
Yeah, just because there are pedophiles doesn't justify covering them up. I mean, every place has pedophiles because there's the statistical number of people who are pedophiles. But yeah, the cover-up is what's the most, well, aside from the damage caused to the victims, the Catholic Church doesn't get away just by saying, but there are pedophiles everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's not the story. And the fact that the leader of a rather large Catholic organization here in the United States would issue this defense, A, makes it clear just how desperate they are to want this matter to go away, and B, I don't know, it's just sickening. Rather than just say, we agree, it's fucked up, we're ashamed, it shouldn't have happened, this guy is going around saying that the kids are homosexuals and they enjoyed it. And this guy, I've seen this, this guy has been interviewed on a number of occasions on Fox News. He is a national figure that, actually, I'm kind of shocked that you guys have never heard of him. Because he's actually a very well-known person in the religious community. And it's just horrifying that anyone would take seriously such a defense, particularly when the defense really doesn't even address what the real problem was. And he knows that. And this is one reason why I'm kind of disgusted by the fact that, in case you haven't heard, Pope John Paul II is another step closer to becoming a saint.
Yeah, I read that story yesterday. It was like, at first I was like, what the hell is beatification? So I had to look it up.
Beatification. It's the second to last step to sainthood. They just got to be able to prove one more miracle. You know, they just make these miracles up.
Is that why they exhumed his body, was to see if it had been untouched by decomposition? So they could say, oh, it's a miracle, and then
probably
make him a saint?
Probably, you know, of course, they go out of their way to preserve the body before they bury it. But also they wanted to get some relics from the body, which they literally took a vial of blood, which is going to be his relic, which is just so morbid and creepy. It's just kind of weird. But
So how many gods do they have? Because they also worship the dead, right?
Yeah. No, you know, as Daryl Ray said, they do really have four gods. No, five gods, because they don't worship Lucifer or Satan, but they give him godlike status, as I think most Christians do, actually.
Well, and I'd say they have more than four gods. I think they've got thousands of gods, because with saints, they treat them as demigods, which is, you know, maybe they're not treating them as high as Mary and Jesus and God himself, but they're still treating them like they're something to be worshipped.
Well, yeah, you're familiar with the patron saint system, where every problem has a patron saint you can pray to. That originally came into existence in response to how the pagans had, you know, the gods of agriculture or the harvest, the god of this, the god of that, and when they were trying to convert people, you know, a farmer would say, "Hey, I can't stop worshiping this god because my crops won't grow." And said, "Hey, you don't need that god. We've got Saint so-and-so. You can just pray to him, and he'll help your crops grow." So that's where that whole system came about. And, yeah, I agree with you that they did kind of elevate the saints to, like you said, not quite god status, but very close. Where I remember as a Catholic, as a kid, praying to Saint Jude every time I lost something. And, you know. And sometimes it took months for St. Jude to get around to helping me, but he almost always did. And I would always credit St. Jude. "Wow, thank you, St. Jude. I've been looking for that baseball glove." And, you know, of course, I went the whole season without it. But, you know, he gets tied up. A lot of people are...
You know, I've never been able to wrap my head around how obviously polytheistic a lot of religions are while still claiming that they are monotheistic.
Mm-hmm.
You've got God the Father and Jesus Christ and the Holy Ghost, but they're really one person, but they're really not, and they're like everywhere, but they're not. And you know, the whole Nicene Creed, and it's like they're trying to cram polytheism into monotheism, and everybody buys it.
Mm-hmm. Which is, it's nonsensical. You have to.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Can I pile on? Before it all breaks.
Oh.
Apparently we haven't hit that limit yet.
No. But I don't know. I mean, I think with the tactic of raising people to believe that from childhood, raising people, you know, when they're at the age where they can still believe in the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, if you convince them of it at that time, you know, they just never think about it later and really contemplate the absurdity of it.
Yeah, it's a given. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it is.
You know, obviously you can't maintain the Santa Claus thing because nobody, you know, at a certain age, people are hoping you figure out that's not true, and they're not continually reinforcing that belief. But it's not the same with the Holy Spirit and Jesus and the Father and Mary and Satan and all the saints. And speaking of the Holy Spirit, what were the Mormons? What's their attitude on the Holy Spirit?
Mormons throw out the Nicene Creed, Mormons view it's the Godhead. They're three separate individuals, but they are one in purpose, and so that's how they kind of get around it's how they cram the polytheism into the monotheism. So God is our Father. Jesus Christ is one of His sons. We are all His children. Jesus Christ just happened to be the best son, and so He got special status. This is real in a nutshell here, and the Holy Ghost is an unembodied spirit child of God, and so the Holy Ghost can be everywhere to influence everybody. Because if He was in a body, it's just logic, right, that He couldn't be in two places at one time, according to Mormon theology, which is really silly. But that's kind of an in the nutshell overview of the Mormon Godhead.
Because I'm not that familiar with Mormon. I know that they don't believe that Jesus is God, at least not yet. He will eventually get his own world, won't he? Or universe.
No, universe, yes.
Yeah, he'll eventually get his own universe, just like any good Mormon will eventually get their own universe. But but as of now, he is still not a god. He's just a very highly elevated human. He's a prophet.
No, he was given special attention. So, this is deep doctrine in the Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To effectively address this, you need to study the theology for decades before you're qualified. I'm dripping with sarcasm here. But you're absolutely right. Jesus, according to Mormon theology, he's our older brother, spirit child of God. Yet he has all these godly powers, yet none of God's children are yet gods, according to their theology, except for Jesus Christ. It's like there's all these exceptions made for this one, and it's just, it's full of holes left and right, and, you've just poked a good one.
All right. Yeah, I've never totally understood the Mormon. It's just,
They're it makes a lot of sense if you don't think too much about it.
Yeah, which is
pretty much religion as a whole.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, goodness. All right. Hey, speaking of abuse within the church, the Catholic Church, the Vatican recently confirmed something that was actually fairly well known, just as priest pedophiles was fairly well known for a very long time in the Catholic Church. But in Africa, there is very common practice of priests abusing their authority and raping nuns. And the nuns are normally terrified to say anything about it, and the priests rely on the nuns as a safe target because they're not going to get AIDS, is their theory, by having sex with a nun. But this has been going on actually for a very long time, and the Catholic Church has finally admitted it, but it's absolutely horrifying when you read the details of how all over the continent of Africa, if you're a nun, you're at a very high risk of being raped by a priest, and then just having absolutely no recourse whatsoever after that happens.
I think you may be missing the main story here, though, Marshall. It's probably that they're actually using condoms. That's probably the real horror story.
Yeah. And I don't think it actually mentions whether or not, but that would be the main sin if they were using condoms.
but here comes the defense, if the adolescents were consenting, these nuns must be consenting too. They must really like it, or they'd say something about
it.
They
wanted it. Yeah.
Well, and not to mention, God must be consenting too, because we're all the pregnancies.
Well, they probably are getting pregnant. I don't know if it goes into how many of these nuns go on to have children, but you're probably right. They probably are using condoms. That's why they're refusing to have them distributed throughout Africa. They're saving them all for themselves.
Well, and the
But
curious thing to me for this too is, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't have to be a virgin to become a nun, nor a priest. You just have to remain celibate once you take your vows, correct?
correct. Yes, you can.
So, who's to say that these women don't have AIDS because they weren't always nuns?
I think the priests might be thinking, I got to have sex with somebody. The nuns are probably my safest bet.
Probably true, but I'm just saying that, it's just kind of a flawed logic to me because, like I said, they could have been these girls could have unfortunately been, abused as children and have diseases and all kinds of stuff,
Well, and this article actually, and I forgot to indicate, I got this off the Richard Dawkins Foundation. It was written by a Francis Kennedy, who writes for the Independent. But this really picked up heavily with the AIDS virus, because of the AIDS virus, where the priests used to travel to another town and find a prostitute and have sex with her. Now they're afraid to do that
Sure.
because Father can't be getting AIDS. It's really a bad image for the church.
But if he's so good, won't God protect him from the AIDS?
That theory has been tested by a number of people, and I don't think it's panned out very well for most of them. But just another example of the absolute failure of the vow of celibacy. This idea that you can expect grown adult men to go their entire life if without ever having an orgasm, because they're also not allowed to masturbate, that's considered equally a mortal sin, to rape or premarital sex or adultery. There are no levels of mortal sins. All mortal sins are just as bad as all the other ones. So if you masturbate, you've done something just as bad as murder. Well, and that's the same thing in Mormonism.
Almost, but yeah, it's there's only one sin worse than murder. There's only one sin worse than having sex outside of marriage, and that's murder, but just barely.
Well, in the Catholic Church, they have the concept of mortal sin and venial sin. And venial sins are like lies, things that won't get you, white lies, stealing a apple from a stand or something like that. It's, not grave in nature. You won't go to hell, you'll go to purgatory. But a single mortal sin, of which masturbation is included, will by itself get you thrown in hell, into hell if you die before you make it to confession. So, and I don't remember how I got onto that rant, but anyway, the situation in Africa is not surprising given the bizarre, freakish restrictions on sexuality for the Catholic clergy, in my opinion. Men are going to, at some point,
Yeah, it's just asking for problems if
Yeah,
you control it to that level.
I'm trying to word it in a way that is appropriate. But men are, no man can go his entire life without an orgasm. It's just a physical imperative that he has one eventually. So.
Well, and that ties into, any religion that has, weird restrictions on sexuality, because we talked about before how in Afghanistan it was kind of like the secret that nobody knew about, which was that, the women are so basically they kind of, it almost sounds like Roman society where women are kind of dirty, and so a lot of the guys have taken to having little boys
Yeah.
for sex partners.
And in parts of Afghanistan it's a very open, it's not even secret. It
Right,
was yeah.
right.
It was shocking to American and British soldiers who went there thinking that they'd find a society that was very anti-homosexuality. But yeah, we talked about that a couple episodes ago. But yeah, the same thing. I mean, it sounds horrible, but like I said, you can't expect a man and probably a woman, I can't speak from personal experience, to go their entire life without some sort of sexual activity.
But you want to know, you know, from the like create yourself an airtight business case, making a sexual sin require you to be there, that's money in the bank right there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's part of the motive behind making masturbation a sin is, and then requiring the sacrament of confession for forgiveness for that sin. They, you know, if someone buys that, they can't quit the church, because at some point they're going to sin and they have to go to confession. And while they're part of that church, you can expect a regular tithe from them.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with the sacrament of confession in the Catholic Church. And I don't think there are any equivalents to confession in other churches or other Christian churches. There used to be in Judaism, which was animal sacrifice, where you had to buy the animal from the priest who was going to sacrifice it for you. But yeah, I think that's a huge part of the motivation between the for the sacrament of reconciliation in the Catholic Church.
Confession is a required step for repentance in the Mormon Church.
Oh, it is. See, I didn't know that.
Yes, and you know, it created a real awkward situation, you know, because in Mormonism, you know, and this was damaging to me as a child, you know, Mormonism, masturbation is a horrible sin as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was growing up, my father was the equivalent of the pastor or whatever. And so when I'm 13 years old, you know, I go and I confess to having masturbated at 13 to my father. Yeah, it's changed my relationship with my father ever since over a silly, ridiculous thing. But, you know, I feel something, it was something that I felt I had to do, you know, to be forgiven of my sins, was to tell my pastor, which happened to my bishop, which happened to be my father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Very awkward and very painful. But, you know, it's, you know, if the church has that hook in you where you have to do that to be clean again, then you do what you have to do.
Yeah. See, I didn't know that about that. It's kind of interesting that you had to do that. So, but you can only do it to your bishop?
Your priesthood leader,
okay.
Which is generally your bishop. There are certain situations where you can bypass the bishop and go to the next level up, which is called the stake president. A stake is about 4,000 or 5,000 members of the Mormon Church, and the one who presides over that whole group, the stake president, and you can go straight to him under certain circumstances. But a 13-year-old boy confessing masturbation isn't one of those circumstances.
No, probably not. Probably not. Not high up on the list of. I'm just amazed that your father was so struck by this.
Well, no, he wasn't. To his credit, he was very understanding. He never got upset at me. Never got angry. So I couldn't have asked for him to handle it any differently. That doesn't change the fact that it was a very difficult, hard thing for me to do.
Well, especially at the time when you had this illusion about the severity of the sin.
Right.
Which I did too when I was in the seminary.
Right. You know, I don't blame my father. He couldn't have handled it any more lovingly. I mean, but, you know, it was still difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a private thing. I think that's the thing about religion that really bothers me, too, is the fact that it's like it's asking you to go tell everybody the most private things you possibly, you know, do by yourself and basically tell everybody, hey, yeah, I did this.
It's fun.
Well, and it's even more disturbing is that when you go in for an interview, you know, with your bishop, which happens every year, he'll probe and he'll ask questions. He'll ask straight up if you've masturbated. which is entirely inappropriate for an older man to be asking that of an adolescent child. What's even more disturbing is that they do the same thing for girls, which is, for me, having two daughters is just absolutely.
It's beyond creepy.
Yes.
But I tell you what, if you are a Catholic and a priest asks you that question, run. Because it's leading somewhere. The conversation's going somewhere, and you don't want to know where it's going. All righty. Enough. There's never enough bashing of the Catholic Church. All right. I've got a kind of a funny story. about a church in Tennessee that opened up a drive-through service for Good Friday and for their Easter services, I believe, as well. I got this from MSNBC. In Old Hickory, Tennessee, an Old Hickory church is offering a drive-through through Good Friday service until midnight. I can give you two guesses as to why they would offer a drive-through service. In my opinion, it's because it's an excellent opportunity for people to get a really quick blessing and then donate money to the church while they're at it.
I was gonna say, I guess so. Or that, or it will get more people to come because they're like, you mean I don't have to sit through a whole sermon? I can just come by and they'll say,
yeah,
hey, you're cool, God be with you, give us $10.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, there's no way they can think. They can honestly believe that a drive-through Good Friday service is bringing anyone closer to Jesus. You know, absolutely no way.
I mean, I can see how it works now. They pull to the speaker and say, "I'll have a number two repentance."
Yeah.
And the pastor responds, "Okay, that'll be $10, please."
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they're that blatant about it, but I mean that's the only motive I can think of is, you know, while they're driving through. We've already got the thing where they can put the money. You know, if they want to put in $10 or $20, and if we want to put up a sign asking for donations, then, you know, it's not harming anybody. I don't know. To me, it's just blatant and obvious what's going on here. Because, like I said, there's no way they're under any illusion that a two-minute drive-through blessing is going to be the difference in anyone's life. You know, this will be the moment that got this person into heaven. They know that's not the truth. This is just a quick opportunity to get a lot of people in and out and get as many donations as they possibly can get. Now, in fairness, the story doesn't actually say that, but that's just an inference I'm making.
So. I can't. Yeah. Well, I can't think of any other reason for it. I mean, it. There's lots of gimmicks I've seen churches do to get more people in on Easter Sunday, which is interesting to me because if you know, if you have the people who don't go very often who are still religious, the times they're gonna go are like Easter and Christmas. So, you know, shouldn't you try this on other holiday you know, non-holidays to get people through? But I don't know, it's weird to me.
Yeah, you know, it did seem a little weird to me that they chose Good Friday is the day to do that. Maybe it was a test run to see how it went. You know, maybe they didn't want to do it on Easter. And I think what they figure is they didn't have to do it on Easter because those people are probably going to show up anyway. You know, the good, as in the Catholic Church, they call those the Easter and Catholic, or the Easter and Christian Catholics. They probably call them that in every other denomination as well. So this is just an opportunity to get them in for another day and perhaps get another donation out of them. Or so I suspect. All right. We got a fascinating story. Have any of you guys heard of Brian Fisher of the American Family Association?
I
can't
not.
Say that I have.
This guy is he is a piece of work. He I think he's affiliated with James Dobson in some way, but he, as most Christians are, and as I am, to be honest with you, is not a big fan of Muslims. Now, I'm not a big fan of any particular religion. I don't exclude it to just Muslims, but this guy has a particular hatred of Muslims, and he's also, I think we've spoken about this guy on other occasions when he's bashing homosexuality in the past, but. He's the director or the president of a very large Christian organization, again, the American Family Association. And I'm getting this story from Secular News Daily, or otherwise known as Palaban.com. This guy is now advocating that the United States should go around invading Islamic nations and that the Marines, on their first time around, should be accompanied by missionaries, and forcefully
work well for the Spanish.
Yes. Oh, it did, actually.
Yeah,
You're right.
that's true.
It was a very, and you know, that might be his model. He got that from the Catholic Church. But he says, this time it's the Marines and missionaries. Next time it'll be Marines and missiles. And obviously what he's saying is, you know, convert or die. He really thinks that this should be the policy of the United States to go around invading Islamic nations, which actually Ann Coulter said in the past as well.
That just shot his credibility straight through the roof.
Yeah.
Which is really funny, because if he professes to dislike, you know, Muslims so much, isn't that their cry too, convert or die?
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a fairly compelling argument.
I suppose.
He's trying to out Taliban the Taliban, I guess. Because you're right, because this is the type of thing that you expect to hear from a Osama bin Laden and those type of individuals that I don't even know if they go that far, to be honest with you. I don't even know if the Taliban and Al-Qaeda goes that far. But this guy is literally saying, the director of a huge Protestant evangelical organization is literally saying the United States needs to invade nations, try to convert them, and then kill them if those efforts fail. Which to me is horrifying that this guy still has a job. You would hope that in any other organization, if you made the mistake of hiring someone this crazy, that once he said that, you'd fire him. Not the case in this situation. This guy still has a job. I don't know if there's any outcry over this, to be honest with you.
You know, he's probably from amongst his organization.
They're
probably giving him mad props for being outspoken and bold.
Yes, he was outspoken and bold. I'll give him that. To me, it's just a little bit horrifying that anyone would want to return to the days of that type of proselytization or conversion attempts.
Well, and the thing is that I would look at this guy and say is, you know, is that what you really want? I thought that, you know, belief is supposed to be something from your heart, something that you believe because you read about, you know, you read the Bible and you accept this to be true. So how can you ever think that these people have actually converted because they feel this in their heart and they feel, you know, all you know, all the warm fuzzy stuff, or they're doing it just because they don't want you to, you know, shoot them in the head? I mean, that's promoting, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, that goes like beyond the Pascal's wager of, you know, the believe just in case, which is totally insincere. But, you know, I just don't see how he could justify saying that this would be okay.
But as we mentioned before, this is not a new tactic. It you know, the Muslims used it in their early days expansions. Christians certainly used it, as Michael said. South America is a testament to that fact. I don't think the goal is not to convert the first generation. It's just to get rid of the Islam, and then future generations will accept Christianity without having to be forced to.
Well, you know, I can agree with the sentiment of wanting to get rid of Islam, but let's not stop there. Let's also go for Christianity and, you know, all the other religions that have been used to oppress humankind over the centuries.
I agree. I certainly don't agree with the tactics of
don't agree with the methods. Yes, they
yeah, yeah.
So,
well, I guess what I'm getting at is you know, I totally agree with what you're saying, that that's a tactic that's been used by, you know, religion for, you know, thousands of years. But I guess the thing that I'm looking at is I'm looking to, you know, the rest of the Christian community that has progressed a little bit further along in their thinking, that they might look at this guy and go, no, this is not, you know, what our mission is to teach. Our mission is not to force people to believe. Our mission is to bring them the message and hope that they accept it. So I don't know. I guess it's what I'm saying is it kind of goes against at least what I would think is a large portion of what a lot of Christians do believe. And, you know, yeah, I'm no fan of Islam. I mean, I've said it many times. I actually think at this point in time, Islam is, we have far more to fear from, you know, the extremists of Islam than we do from Christian extremists at this point. But, you know, I'm still not, you know, going to say that the remedy is to go and kill them all, you know?
Well, you know, and that's the amazing thing is that there really isn't any outrage that there should be. A lot of times you hear criticism of Muslims whenever a terrorist does something or extremist says something that's just absolutely horrifying. And, you know, people say, where are the Muslim moderates denouncing this? You know, I'm actually reading more about this guy. This guy says this kind of crap all the time. I wouldn't have heard about him if I hadn't read about him in these articles that I get off the news.
So, yeah, you bring up a good point. Where are the Christian moderates denouncing this?
Right. Where are the Christians saying, you know, this is a terrible message to be sending? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, because – I mean, I see other articles. This guy said a lot of this kind of crap. He proposes that all immigrants to the United States should be required to convert to Christianity before they can come to the United States, which is obviously about as unconstitutional as you can. Well, using the Marines to force conversions is also fairly unconstitutional as well. This guy doesn't give a damn about the Constitution, and I think what you find is that most, even though they say they love the Constitution, most of these right-wing Christians don't give a damn about the First Amendment.
Well, I think I think they don't understand it.
Yeah, I think they care about the Constitution as it's been spoon-fed to.
Yeah, but there's just absolutely no way that even the most delusional right-winger could possibly think invading nations to force conversions could possibly be constitutional.
Well, yeah, I completely agree, but I do hear a lot of times people doing the whole, well, but we're the, you know, I think it was a story back around Christmas time that there was a city hall display of the nativity, and they were told to take it down, and they were like, well, we're the majority, we should be, if we vote for it, they should be able to leave it there, and they don't really understand it. It's like, we don't live in a mob rule society, we live in a society of law. And that display, you know, I would oppose a display of, you know, Judaism or, you know, Muslim holiday just as much as I would, you know, oppose a display of the nativity. You know, it's like, move it down the street a few blocks to somebody who's willing to put it on their property. But, you know, you can't have it on state property just because the whole community says it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. I mean, every Christian in the country can put a nativity scene in their front yard. There's something other than what they're claiming that's the motivation for them thinking it has to be in the, you know, at the town hall or the courthouse or whatever. Because, I mean, like, literally you can have them everywhere. I could go out and put a nativity scene in my front yard right now and it would be perfectly legal. But what's the motive for getting it in the in government buildings is really the question. Because, and I don't know. I just really am of the suspicion that these guys really don't give a damn about the First Amendment. But like you said, Michael, what they're told about it is completely inconsistent with what it actually says and what the intention of the Founding Fathers was. And you,
because they're fed a, you know, a homogenized version of history too, because so many of them seem to forget that the whole reason why the pilgrims came to the United States was to get away from a government that was telling them how to practice their religion, and they didn't want somebody telling them what they could believe and how they could worship and how they could believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they really want a theocracy and they want somebody to get someone in government to come tell them how they can worship, then, you know, I guess they just don't understand the ramifications of involving government with religion and vice versa.
Well, exactly. Even in the colonies, Christian on Christian discrimination was huge. It was going on all the time. You even had Protestants attacking Christians, Christians attacking Protestants, states banning Catholics from public office, Catholics banning Protestants from public office. You had a lot of that, and the very purpose of the First Amendment was to put an end to all that crap.
Well, yeah, they wanted freedom to have their own beliefs. They didn't want other people to have that same freedom, and so they came here and created their own little groups where, you know, and a lot of that is still common today. There are still areas where it's very Protestant or very Catholic, or, you know, and it's like that because these people group together in communities because they didn't want to allow somebody else to believe differently. They simply wanted it to be for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a hypocritical example from our founding.
Well, our pre-founding fathers, the yes. Colonial, I don't know what you would use the term, the colonists who existed here before, before we were founded as a new nation. But anyway, that was the motive behind it, and it. A lot of Christians seem to have forgotten the extent to which they're protected by the First Amendment and by having a government that doesn't take a stand on religion. Hopefully they never get to experience a government that does, is my hope. Anyway. So, all right, I got one last story. And this one's going to be a shocker. So you guys are sitting down, aren't you?
Yes.
Can't wait.
All right, there's this, according to the dailynews.com, newyorkdailynews.com, there is a anti-gay pastor named Grant Storm from New Orleans. He was sitting in a, he was recently caught sitting in a public park, and I'm going to give you a guess as to what he was doing.
It was probably with his boyfriend.
No, well, close. That was actually probably a good guess. No, he was. This is a guy who promoted himself as an advocate of Christian sexual morality and very anti-gay. He was watching some children and pleasuring himself at the time. And,
wow.
And the amazing thing is I really debated whether I should even mention this because I don't know if this qualifies as news anymore. does it? And that's my whole point of mentioning this. Does this qualify as news anymore? Some radically anti-gay Christian values pastor caught doing the opposite of exactly what he's been saying his entire life.
You know, I think it does simply because I think we have to keep putting a mirror up to the faces of these people and saying, look, these are the people that are leading you. And it's not to say that there's nothing wrong with, you know, being gay. There's nothing wrong with making a mistake because, you know, sometimes, you do something that is totally wrong that, you know, that you didn't necessarily mean to do. But most of the time, these guys that do this stuff don't make a simple mistake. They know exactly what they're doing, you know. And who was it? Who was the pastor, the big one that, you know, he was Haggard,
yeah.
I mean, you know, and he didn't accidentally do blow and sleep with a bunch of guys. I mean, that wasn't an accident, you know. And to me, it's just saying, at the very least, it's pointing out that the people that you listen to are just as flawed as the rest of us, or even saying that, you know, they're not even flawed. I'll go one step further and say they are just taking money from you hand over fist and laughing at you. Because it's not even about morality. Because I wonder what kind of a church he was a pastor of. Because I kind of doubt it was a little neighborhood church. The real vocal ones tend to have really big congregations and pull in lots of money.
Yeah, and it doesn't really say. But apparently he was fairly renowned. I've never heard of him myself, but apparently he was well known in the area, and he describes himself as a Christian patriot. And an advocate of, you know, decent Christian sexual morality, but again, it's almost to the point where, when a person carries on that much about these sexual issues, you almost start to suspect it of them.
Because somebody protesteth too much.
Yeah.
Right.
Because this happens with such frequency. I don't have the whole list in front of me, but it's just it's gotten to the point where it really isn't surprising. I don't know if I'll even when I continue, maybe I'll continue mentioning this stuff, but when I find it in the news, but it's really just gotten to the point where you know, maybe I'll just start mentioning the number of pastors who got caught masturbating in a park or molesting a child or something like that, instead of just actually reading the entire story. That might be worth doing it.
I think it's interesting because I don't know. I mean, I you know, it's baby steps, right? But maybe if these stories keep coming out, maybe more Christians will start thinking, maybe I shouldn't trust these authority figures so much. You know, basically trying to get the whole idea of, you know, the idea that just because someone claims that they're an authority on something doesn't mean that they are, you know, and maybe they'll, you know.
Well, and it's been my experience that invariably the most corrupt and just absolutely rotten member of a given religious community is typically the leader, you know.
Sure, but, power corrupts.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Well, you know, I've always found, you know, that, you know, these members of churches tend to almost worship or look up to their leaders to such a high degree that they feel that they're above reproach. And having since leaving religion myself, I've come to the thought that, you know, the people and the organizations that say or allow the idea to be propagated and continue that they are above reproach or they're above criticism. Mm-hmm. Those are the exact groups and the exact people that need the most criticism. They're the ones who need to have it shouted from the hilltops, to borrow a phrase from you know, the theists, that these people are not who they claim to be, and these people need to be investigated with more regularity, more scrutiny, more thoroughness than, you know, your typical parishioner.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
Right. Well, and what I mean too by power corrupts is I don't think that just because they gain a bunch of power that turns them into pedophiles. What I mean is just that it gives them the arrogance to think that they can get away with it. It gives them the arrogance to think, I'm this moral leader, so nobody will ever think this of me, and you know what I mean. It just makes them think they can. Or the same thing with those who swindle a bunch of people out of their money, or end up sleeping with, you know, adult women by, you know, seducing them, because you hear about that too. Or even I think Jesse Jackson recently has been called and slapped with a lawsuit for not only discriminating against a homosexual employee of his, but even propositioning him for sexual favors.
Are you serious? I hadn't heard that one.
I am dead serious. Yeah, I heard this last week. And I don't know. Now, you know, this is all, of course, alleged. So, but I wouldn't put it past Jesse Jackson to, at the very least, have been nasty to this guy.
None of it's surprising.
No,
I'm not saying that about what I know about Jesse Jackson, but just about what we've seen in the past from people in those positions. You almost get to the point where you expect that type of thing.
Right.
But I agree with you about, Jennifer, the arrogance of an individual who – because I wonder if they think that they're somehow exempt. I know, you know, thinking, you know, I know I condemn this, but I have a higher calling, and God will understand if I do it myself. I don't know. It's hard to get into the brain of these people because their lives are so inconsistent with their words. But I don't know. Just the how often this occurs. That would almost be worthy of some sort of psychological study. The frequency with which people in these positions of religious authority are normally the opposite of what they claim to be.
Well, you know, sure. Well, probably because that's the type of people that are attracted to such levels of authority.
Mm-hmm. You might be right.
Take advantage of it. I mean, I'm certainly not in every case, because there are they're people. They're decent. There's plenty of decent pastors. But I'm sure it also attracts a certain portion of the population that simply wants to take advantage of the and use it for their own benefit.
No, I agree. And, you know,
well, Yeah, and I would say too that the reason that I'm sure a big reason why the clergy does seem to attract more pedophiles and and people who are I don't want to say homosexual in a bad way, but just that people that are trying to deny their sexual proclivities is because that's what they're trying to do. They think if I do this, it'll keep me in check. And I think that once they gain a bunch of power, then they think, well, maybe since I've got all this power, I don't know, I do think that's an attraction too, is that they are trying to deny a part of who they are, and miserably failing, unfortunately, because they're putting themselves in situations where they're tempted.
But I think Michael did hit on something that I think I saw when I was in the seminary, of individuals who were in the seminary studying to become priests, not because of the religious conviction so much, but because they were attracted to the lifestyle, to the position of authority. And maybe that's more common than I thought, that the people who do go on to become pastors do so because of the authority connected with it and not because of their devotion to their religious beliefs.
Sure. I think it's both. I totally agree with both assessments. Mm-hmm. it's an attention. It's a place of authority and the spotlight too.
Absolutely. And
there's a constant question that debate that's going on amongst fellow ex-Mormons such as myself about if these leaders really believe, because there's just so much out there, and it goes into this point of does there come a point where a religious leader knows it's a crock of shit but still continues on because there's a lot of benefit to them personally to continue the illusion?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of data showing that well, just from the pastors who eventually did leave the faith, that they struggled with it for a very long time and remain a pastor for years after they had, become an agnostic or an atheist or a deist or whatever they had become, because they enjoyed the job, they needed the money, and they were going to be disowned by virtually everyone they knew. So,
and the money was good.
Yeah, the money was good, and I think that happens a lot more often than anyone would be willing to admit, because I can't honestly say that if I had gone on to become a Catholic priest and then became an atheist after that, I mean, that's a big leap. I mean, you're just going from being a member of the clergy and dedicating your life and really having that as your only skill. You have no marketable skills after that. And then leaving it all, I don't know how you do it. I really don't. So, anyway.
I can understand being caught in that spot. Yeah, it's a terrible spot to be in, to know that what you went to go, study, you can't do it anymore. But then thinking, what do I do for money?
Yeah, I know. It's a tough decision. And I can't really judge anyone who abandons the faith but continues on, because I'm not in that situation, and I've got a job, and I'm not in a position where I'd have to lose everything to make that decision. I can understand it, and I think we would be shocked if we knew the true number of pastors, regardless of the religion, who find themselves in that position.
I agree.
So all right. Well, that's the last story I've got. So we might as well wrap it up. Michael, thank you for your first appearance on the Agnostic Salvation Hour.
And
not a problem. And I was thinking, I'll drag this on a little bit more. I was actually thinking about changing the name, because I noticed on iTunes, majority of the people who download us are also download other agnostic podcasts, and I think I'm starting to think that a lot of people who consider themselves atheist are kind of turned off by the name. I don't know that for sure. Yeah, I really do. I think, oh, that's agnostic. I'm not listening to that.
See that. Yeah,
because I got harassed not too long ago on Facebook by some lunatic who absolutely hated agnostics. And just let you know, I'll go by agnostic, atheist. I'm not sure I really see what the difference is anymore. I don't care.
I'm an agnostic atheist. I don't know, but I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I do think that to say flat out atheist means you absolutely know there's nothing out there, and I can't say that, but I can say with absolute certainty that it's none of the gods that we've come up with.
Absolutely, and I just can't imagine.
I agree.
I don't understand. There does seem to be some animosity on both sides, and I don't really get it, to be honest with you. Yeah, there are some agnostics who don't want to associate with atheists and vice versa. And I really do not understand that, to be honest with you.
Speaking from, you know, being young when I was younger and thinking I'm so much more expanded and so much better because I call myself an agnostic because that means I'm open to everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that categorizes all agnostics, but that was definitely my attitude. Mm-hmm. And I kind of get that from those that I think have that problem, you know, with the whole labeling themselves as agnostic. I do kind of see that sometimes. They kind of are almost angry that you say you're atheist because they think that you are not open to any possibilities.
And that's not just among agnostics that think that. I mean, that a lot of... Everybody, when you say you're an atheist, like, oh, you know there's not a God? I'm like, no, I don't know, but
right.
I'm so sure that it makes no difference in my life, you know? So,
yeah, the whole is there or isn't there a God thing really has no impact in my life. I mean, somebody could prove to me tomorrow that there was a God, and that still wouldn't change my attitudes towards religion at all.
Precisely.
I think I would, sometimes they don't like using this term, but I guess I'm more accurately a anti-theist than an atheist or agnostic. Ultimately, I don't even care. If somebody calls me an atheist, I'm not going to correct them because they're not necessarily wrong, for one thing. And if someone calls me an agnostic, I'm not going to say, no, I'm an atheist. I honestly do not care. But anyway, I've been contemplating a name change for the show because I have noticed that we're kind of getting not embraced by the atheist community as much as we are by the agnostic community, and I embrace them both personally. So I don't know. Maybe
same
I won't.
Here. I say everybody should listen. Yay!
Yeah, I think anyone who deist, agnostic, atheist, as long as you're a free thinker and you understand the absurdity of human religion. I got no problem with you. So, anyway. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for the show. Again, Michael, thank you. Oh, and I didn't mention at the beginning of the show, Cole was attempting to be on the show with us. He has had trouble figuring out how to use Skype. So, hopefully, we'll have him on the next time. But until then, this was the Agnostic Salvation Hour, and thank you for listening, everyone. No.